Hi, this is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hi, folks. This week on episode 9 of the podcast, Adam Hinton. Adam is a photographer who for 25 years has managed to combine a successful career shooting advertising campaigns for a diverse range of clients, including huge global brands such as Adidas, Nike, BMW and Sony, with his own personal documentary projects. Although he always had his eye on an advertising career, he began his photographic odyssey as a photojournalist when in the early 90s his interest in politics took him to the Ukraine in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, where he focused his attention on the coal mining community in Donetsk. Since then, he has travelled all over the world, including to Gaza, Egypt, Indonesia, the Philippines, India, Venezuela, Brazil and all over Africa. Much of his personal work over the past decade has focused on the slums of the developing world, and it was as part of that project that in 2013 he went to El Salvador, where he ended up in a prison shooting portraits of members of the notorious Mara Salvatrucha gang, the results of which have now been published in a book, MS-13, published by Paul Belford, paulbelford.com. Hope you enjoy the interview. I enjoyed it. Here's Adam. So I'm here in my kitchen with Adam Hinton. Hi, Adam. Thanks for coming, man.
Thank you for asking me.
I thought we'd start off talking about your kind of latest project, which you've just done a book of, MS-13.
Yeah.
Let me try and pronounce the name of the gang. It was Mara Sal...
What is it? Salvatrucha, I think.
Mara Salvatrucha.
My English isn't brilliant. Yeah,
another Londoner.
My Spanish.
Yeah, exactly. I had a number of Londoners on. So you're following a long, well, very short tradition, but yeah, no doubt Spanish speakers will cringe at our mangling of that pronunciation. But basically, it's a gang in El Salvador.
There's two gangs.
Yeah.
That predominate in El Salvador.
And it's one of them.
Yeah, and it's probably the main gang running around in Central and South America at the moment. And they're a big organisation, yeah. And, you know, it's... I suppose what I've been doing some projects on people who... It kind of developed. I worked in Brazil for about 3 or 4 years in one favela, focusing around the life of one or two families, which is kind of a blueprint for some of the projects I do. And that kind of extended. Once I'd finished that, I thought I'd like to do something about, well, just people who live in slums, you know. And it was actually, I didn't want to do anything about gangs. So I wanted to move away from the sort of usual stereotype of it being really violent and full of vice and that, and just show that it's ordinary, normal families, 95-98% of the population there, and they just want to get on with life in that kind of way. But you, certainly in South and Central America, you do get the idea how, and in the parts of Africa, that gangs are quite an integral part of the communities, not in a way you'd expect, like that they're enemies of the communities. They're actually, I mean, we're talking poor districts, and they're the kids from those communities. They end up joining these gangs. This is kind of vicious circle that goes on where they don't have many opportunities, and that's what you end up doing for some of the kids. But as I say, it's difficult to talk to them. Didn't really want to necessarily do that. And then I heard about this gang truce through BBC World Service, Linda Pashley, but she's a really very helpful journalist. I contacted her and she put me in contact with her fixers. And I basically thought this would be an opportunity to talk to gang members.
Mm. Yeah. So what made you sort of change your mind that it was something you had been avoiding, and then suddenly you thought, well, actually, maybe it's worth looking into?
I suppose the initial idea of the project wasn't to do that. And also it is difficult. I mean, when I was in Brazil, it got harder and harder as they changed the laws relating to gang membership and being found with a gun and things like that. It became quite much more difficult to get hold of and talk to gang members, and they're always behind this veil of secrecy as well, because they don't want to be found out by the police so much. And Linda had been there and managed to speak to some of the gang members, and I thought, actually, yeah, you know, it's an interesting what goes on. You know, when I was in Brazil, the gangs are kind of part of the community. It's like that they need them, but they don't want them. So one, you know, they're obviously very violent. A lot of killing goes on, but also the communities feel like they protect them as well. They're part, you know, from the police and rival gangs.
Yeah, kind of a necessary evil in some ways.
In some ways, yeah. So I mean, it was one place that was quite weird. They had glass cabinets in the which were full of like trinkets and trophies and sweets. And some mannequins and stuff, and they had them dotted around this community, and no one ever broke into them, which was unusual. You know, you think it's just sitting there, anyone could have a go at it. And then he discovered actually what happens every Sunday: gang members go out, open them up, get all the sweets that they put in there, and throw them out to the kids. And so I went along on a Sunday and joined them doing this. You know, it's like there's this kind of relationship that goes on, and I thought, with this thing in El Salvador, I could talk to these people. I mean, yeah, what I found in El Salvador was probably it was pretty bad, the situation in the communities there. So,
and where you ended up actually photographing was a prison, essentially, where those gang members had already been incarcerated. And how did you get the access? That you had a kind of amazing access. Did it surprise you how good that was when it happened?
I was quite quite fortunate in some respects. I spoke to Alex, my fixer, and he said he could get me into the prison, but there's no guarantee, and you won't know until a day or two beforehand. So you know, it's looking okay. He'd got a relationship with the gang members, and he'd spoken to them, and it was the leadership was in the prison. They seemed to be okay about it. He said, "Well, you might as well just come out and try it." And then I wanted to do something a bit like the previous projects I'd done about life in the barrio there, and a bit about the gangs. I mean, when I got there, there was nothing. It was so dead economically in the barrio. I thought, this will take me so long to get any material because people aren't doing anything. So I focused on the gangs. And then on the Thursday, on a Wednesday night, we heard, yeah, we can go and talk to the leadership, the governor had approved, and on Thursday off we went. Jumped in a car, and it was a couple of hours away, and then spent about 4 hours in the prison, I think.
So everything you shot was basically one trip. It was, you didn't go back. It was all in that one time.
What was interesting, I mean, I work quite quickly, so I generally spend a week, maybe 10 days on a project, and then I'm pretty knackered, pretty burnt out. I do a bit of stills, a bit of video, and then come back. And because my slum project was like a long-term thing, looking at different communities, I was just going to one community, then coming back, going to another one. I mean, with the El Salvador, a lot happened in the week that I was there in the community and going to the prison and everything. But I came back because it was a Monday, Tuesday, I think. So not a lot was going to happen till the weekend. I was pretty knackered. So, and then I tried to go back about a month later and was told, no, you can't, because it's got a bit hairy.
Right.
And so nothing, it should blow over, so don't wait. And I tried to go back to give it a couple of months. So I did give it a couple of months, and it just got a lot worse. And
so by
6 months after I'd been, I tried to go back again. He said, look, you just forget it. It's literally falling apart. We've got the gangs are hiring ex-paramilitary police and members of the army to train them in urban warfare and stuff like that. It's got really bad.
Mm. So you kind of had your window in a way.
I did. I had a window, and I wish I'd spent longer there, obviously, at that point, but I had to get back.
I mean, I'm wondering whether you did you consider that maybe you didn't have enough material for the book, because there are, how many pictures in there is quite a small number.
It's quite a small number. I think when I went to the prison, I mean, you get one, you're going to be allowed in for the afternoon. That's it. You know, they're not going to let you go backwards and forwards because it's quite difficult to. I got what material I could. If I'd gone back to El Salvador, I wouldn't have gone back to the prison because it would have been a bit, I felt repetitive. I mean, and I work with Paul Belford. He's a designer that we work quite closely together. He kind of partly said he'd like to do his, he's published a book with the portraits, keeping it quite simple. And he's designed it around that. And I thought, yes, I do. I mean, you know, the books, it's a vehicle to talk about some of the issues, hopefully you get people in, you know, looking at the website maybe. You know, and it's also a vehicle for me. It does help me get more work.
Yeah. So was it his idea to sort of focus on the portraits? Because you did, yes. You did other stuff as well, sort of reportage-y kind of.
Yeah, no, we did. I mean, I spent most of my time in this community, La Victoria's, and got on with the gang very quickly there. And they just let me photograph them without masks and stuff like that. Occasionally when they got guns out, they wanted to put headscarves on and stuff like that. But they were quite cool about it. I spoke to a couple of other gang leaders there. But that's a bigger story. Mm. I think Paul wanted to keep it because I've done another book with him from Japan. It's called Tsuburé. And we wanted to keep it a similar size to that because he's also would like to do something from the Ukrainian stuff I've done. But it just takes, I mean, he's busy, I'm busy. It just takes, I mean, it does take about 2 years to get a book out, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the portraits basically are kind of shots of these guys that are very extensively tattooed all over the faces and, you know, and torsos. I noticed that, you know, I mean, some people have said that, you know, they look threatening or hostile or whatever, but it seems to me they don't really. I don't know how you feel about it. That seems to me they look strangely vulnerable.
I mean, I didn't think they looked threatening to me.
Some of them are really quite baby-faced if you look beyond the tattoos.
So it's funny, some of the comments I got with... I did look at the first... I had an interview with The Guardian, and then I started looking at some of the comments, and which you soon learn not to bother.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Have you actually looked at some of the comment threads? Because
Some of them are saying, like, oh, they're a bit podgy, aren't they? They're not very muscular.
Yeah.
Really silly things.
Stupid things. But also, there's also a kind of whole line of kind of quite kind of hateful...
I was really shocked about that. The amount of, like...
Invective.
Oh, yeah, let's... what they need to do is lock the door and just bomb the place.
Yeah.
It's like... that's the crass stereotype of, like, you know, people are... they're all just minus thugs.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I mean, the whole idea I was trying to get...
Yeah, undo. Yeah. I mean, my thought was, well, if this is the Guardian comment thread, what's the fucking Daily Mail one look like?
I know.
And so I went to the Daily Mail comment thread because your pictures actually were in the Daily Mail. And the amazing thing was that it was kind of like the whole world turned upside down because the first... I've got it. Hang on. Where is it? The first one I saw... on the Daily Mail was, these men still deserve our respect as fellow humans and are our brothers. They should not be abandoned in a situation where the law of the jungle rules and they are completely idle, but should be receiving rehabilitation and have meaningful work to do while they serve their sentences. That was in the Daily Mail.
I know it's one
comment. It's not representative or anything. It's totally random, but it did kind of surprise me it kind of made me think, wow, you know, that's...
I mean, I saw a few comments. There was one that was from, I don't know what it's called, Planet something. It's like, and it said like, wow, my God, the reactionary morons really have come out of the woodwork on this one. What are the, you know, I mean, what I was pleased about is, like, actually there wasn't many comments of like, we think Adam Hinton's a dickhead for doing this. You know, it was actually, I'd say 95% of the comments were about the gangs and, you know, are they mindless thugs? Should we like relook at how we approach this kind of thing, you know? And I felt the guys there, they were quite docile. They were quite welcoming. They were very friendly and open.
And obviously, you know, some of these guys have committed horrendous violent crimes. But, you know, violence begets violence, I guess. And clearly, you know, you have to look at it in the context of what they've experienced in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I got that feeling, you know, that... I mean, they have done horrendous things, I'm sure, but I wasn't there to talk about that, because everyone talks about that. You see those knucklehead programs, you know, sometimes from the States, you know, like, oh, I'm going to prison. Yeah, these guys have ripped children's heads off and eaten them alive. You know what I mean? That kind of, they're coming out with that kind of stuff. And it's, well, we all know about that. But I basically looked at it as a community that was absolutely screwed. I mean, there was nothing going on there. I mean, and I was there during a truce. There were two gang-related deaths in the week that I was there. You know, so they had two funerals in a small little community during this truce. People are frightened, people are scared. And, you know, for young adolescents growing up, you know, I know what my kids are like. They're, you know, they're a bit feisty. They want a bit, you know, I would have joined the gang. I'm pretty sure I would have actually been in that situation with that kind of poverty and that no other options. Yeah. I mean, the gangs came from LA. Yeah, they were an exodus from the Civil War. The big refugees, a lot of them went to LA, found a mini civil war going on between the police and the communities there. And they formed a gang along the lines of LA gangs to protect themselves. When they came back to Salvador, I mean, people don't want to hear about this, but they had this, you know, basically the left had lost the civil war. Let's call it reconciliation. This is bullshit. They'd lost it because the poor are still there, a massive amount of numbers. They came back. You still had paramilitary death squads going into those communities, lining up kids and shooting them all, just to say, you're back and we're the bosses, you know. Mm. So they carried on. They formed gangs to protect themselves. That's what some of the initial... And the idea that they deal in drugs, I had to... I photographed a gang leader. His request that I took him and his family out to lunch. Mm. The guys at what I photographed, they asked for a bit of pot, $10 to get a bit of smoke, and fried chicken and chips for lunch. That was what they asked for. I'm like, I'm not going to deny them that. But there was no like, oh, you know, pay us lots of money, you need to do this. Just need to feed us, because we're fucking starving. Mm. Excuse me. You know, we're hungry. Yeah, and...
Yeah, and it seems almost as though the tattooing thing is almost like, you know, some kind of armor or something against, you know, the threat of violence. It's almost like, you know, if you're trying to make yourself look as mean as possible, then maybe there's a chance you'll get left alone, you know, no one's going to kill you. Did you get a sense of that?
I suppose the sense that I got was like, you know, that these people at that age, they absolutely... They just had no idea or care beyond being in the gang. Nothing else meant anything to them. They'd lost all focus and hope about anything else. And so they're putting all these tattoos on their faces, which just marks them out. You know, they step outside their communities or outside an MS area, they're going to get killed. You know, and that the horizon line was literally the next day or the next hour. There was nothing beyond that because there was nothing for them. I don't think.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting talking to the leadership. I mean, they're the older guys. Some of them have come from LA. The way they dressed was like going back into the 80s. You know what I mean? It's like they're all dressed like LA gangster kind of style. And it was like, they probably just come to realize this is just going on and on and on. We're older now. And if we don't try and draw a line under it, it's going to just carry on. Mm. But like one of on the second trip that I was trying to go back on, they'd had a big bit of a revolution, and there'd been a day of killing by MS. They'd gone out and killed 30 members of the other gang, their leadership in San Salvador. So they overthrew that leadership in a way. So I don't know what the internal political situation got on in MS at that time, but it was, yeah, up in the air. Mm. That's when it really broke down.
Mm. Yeah. And a lot of people have made a lot out of the kind of headline of, you know, photographer risks his life in the world's most dangerous prison.
I know, that's...
Was it really like that?
No. Not, you know, I mean, having worked in favelas and stuff like that, you know... is when there's a gang structure like that, once you get permission from the gang, you're okay to go in. Yeah, they might be restrictive about the times. They don't like you there in the evening because that's when they start dealing and stuff like that. So, but you can go in. And I think the people there understand this photographer isn't just going to be wandering around. I usually would have someone from the community with me. I'd have to have that, my fixer, and a local community that everyone recognises. So they'd know he's there, he's got permission. leave him alone. I mean, I worked in one favela, the first one I did in Brazil, and I stopped it because I was still getting guns pointed at me quite regularly, and the police kept coming in as well, which was, then you had to run for cover and stuff like that. So but I found a kind of different kind of community to work in Brazil. Hmm. And the same with the prison. I mean, the prison inmates, that they know you haven't just strolled off the street by mistake. You know what I mean? Oh, look, I'm in a prison.
Sure.
No, and I'm there with the leadership's permission.
Right.
No one's going to touch you.
Right. It's actually, they've got quite a disciplined structure in that sense. They're kind of,
they are
following the rules.
Well, they have to run the whole prison themselves, effectively. So there is quite a lot of people are quite, I'd imagine that they're quite relaxed, and they're probably safer in there than they probably would be on the outside in some respects.
Yeah.
Because they're with their colleagues. That's probably how they feel.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, so, and it's kind of part, as you say, of a broader project, which is kind of, well, an ongoing thing that you've been doing for a long time.
Yeah, it's kind of drew to a bit of a stop because I wasn't sure, again, with a lot of projects, it's like, where's it going? Does anyone want to publish it? Is anyone interested in what I'm saying about these things? I'm not sure if they are that much. I don't know. So I went back to doing a bit more journalistic kind of stuff. Maybe El Salvador gave me a bit of a taste for doing something a bit more journalistic. So I did a couple of things on the protests in Egypt and in the Ukraine, which are kind of more self-contained stories in a way. But that was I was interested in what was going on. I worked in the Ukraine 20 years ago. My first big project was there. So I was quite interested in that.
Right. You've got quite a keen interest in politics. You started out kind of coming from that engaged political perspective. Is that fair to say? Because your first thing was just shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you went to
The collapse of the Soviet Union and Ukraine declared independence, and I decided it was an open door, you could go in. So I thought it'd be interesting just to see what was happening. I'd done Soviet politics at A level, and I was quite interested in that.
Oh, right, okay. Not a degree,
and I did that in photography.
Oh, okay.
Basically, because it was good to be a student back then. You know, you were state funded.
Yeah.
You know, and so
they paid you to go there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd been on the dole, I'd had a job, and then I went back to being a student because I failed all my O levels and stuff. It was like, just got them back again. Yeah. And I discovered, well, that's the best option at the moment. Mm. And I can do a 3-year course just to explore what I'm interested in.
Right.
Because the odd thing is, I actually wanted to be an advertising photographer initially. Then during the miners' strike, got into using photography. And you know how it intertwined with politics.
All right, because I kind of got the impression it was the other way around. Conventional.
Yeah, it's ironic. I don't know why I wanted to do it, but I've kind of thought that was where you go, commercial photography.
Okay. But so even though you were quite interested in politics, it didn't initially occur to you to combine that interest with the photography. You were more interested
not until the miners' strike. I was still a teenager, so I was quite young.
Did you get into it in the first place? I think your dad bought you a camera, didn't he?
Yes, I'm not quite sure. I mean, my dad bought me a really basic Ricoh SLR, I still remember it, you know, with a lens, when I was about 12, and that for him to do that, which, you know, we didn't have lots of money, it was a big, big ask, and he did.
But you don't particularly remember why you... I mean, you must have been quite into it.
I must have been into it, but I'm not quite sure what it was about. You know, it worked from there,
And what kind of stuff did you go around shooting?
I was just photographing friends and my surroundings. I mean, that's the thing. It soon became an interesting way of exploring yourself and your surroundings, in a way. That's what interested me.
Yeah.
And then, because I failed my O-levels, I went to Richmond College to do my retakes. And I was always down for my plan was to go do A-level photography and then do a degree in it. But when I had to do my retakes, and I went to do photography, was one of them. And then it was a 3-year part-time diploma in photography. And I worked at a high street photographer's for about 3 months, which was dreadful. Yeah, absolutely. And it soon put me completely off that.
Right.
Went back on the dole And then I was working with my daddy as a gardener, and I got this booklet about degree courses, which there was probably about half a dozen or a dozen, I think, at the time. And said, well, I just said, I'm going back to college to do some A-levels and get into, go and do a degree.
Right.
You know, so I didn't want to be a gardener.
Right. So. And what was it like growing up? Did you have quite a misspent youth, do you think?
A misspent youth?
Yeah, you know,
my mother's mentally ill, so she was in and out of prison and Broadmoor and things like that.
Wow.
I suppose the first thing I remember was she stabbed my dad in front of me, and then we went off to hospital.
Right.
So we had a lot of that going on, outbursts like that.
Yeah. That must have been incredibly difficult.
Well, you know, when you're young, you just deal with it.
Yeah.
In a way.
But was photography part of that dealing with it, do you think? Did it escape? Was it a kind of escape?
I think it was. Because, my mum got custody. They finally split up when I was seven. She got custody of me. And then I got this blank period where I was living with her until she decided to go travelling around UK because she's been persecuted, supposedly. So I lived with my dad from then on, from nine. And, yeah, I think that obviously grounded me. Mm. I think photography was probably part of that. Certainly in my years when I was 16, 17, 18, you know, because I got much more into it once I got to college, you know what I mean? And I learned a lot more about it, you know. I think beforehand it was a kind of like, there was a calling. I don't know what it was. I just wanted to be a photographer, you know. And that's when it really came in.
And so did you start getting kind of commercial work quite early on, or how did that work? Because you decided you wanted to do the kind of...
I was lucky. I mean, that I'd done this, I was doing a diploma one day a week, and then for 3 years. And then the first year I actually had a bit of a job, then I had the dole. Then I decided to go back for the last 2 years to the diploma to do two A-levels as well to get into college. And that kind of gave me a bit of a commercial focus on what you have to do to get some work. So when I was at Poly, it was like, well, I'm doing stuff for the course and stuff for my folio, because I knew at the end of the day I did, and luckily my year was very commercially focused, you know. They more photographers came out of that year than any previous year because we wanted to be photographers. So I made sure that I had a really good portfolio, a decent portfolio, you know. Like, I did projects pretending to be it to be a college project just from a portfolio. And there was a kind of route, you know. You go and work for places, things like Times Educational Supplements, Time Out, Nursing Times. Mm. And also, you could then go and see The Guardian, you could see The Telegraph, you could see The Observer, Independent Magazine. And you could, I got commissions from them as well in the first few months of leaving college. Right. So... And then you met other, like Simon Norfolk, Justin Layton, Paul Lowe. There we were, you know, knocking around. Mm. That was they came from Newport, I came from Trent, but there was a little gang of us in a way, a little group. I wasn't that close to them, but that you could sense that there was
Right. And I think most of those guys that you mentioned were sort of going down the kind of documentary road, but I guess what's interesting is that, you know, it's extremely difficult to have a successful career as a commercial photographer or as any other kind of photographer. Most people pick one thing or the other, but you seem to have pulled off this kind of magic trick whereby you have always done both and you continue to do both. And I'm wondering about that and whether that's a very conscious effort on your part. Do you have to work at going, like, I'm going to not get pulled one way or the other, but I'm going to...
I suppose my fortunate thing is I've always managed to separate personal work from commercial work.
Right. Way.
I mean, you know, when I left college, my first, I did a little trip to India for a week. I self-financed it. You know, I saved up money and self-financed it. The Ukraine job was all, that was over a 3-4 year period. I self-financed everything. So it's like, I didn't want to go to these things and do with commissions or having to get certain pictures for certain magazines, you know, because even if they just gave you like, here's 200 quid, but can you do some shots for us around the centre of Donetsk or something like that? I didn't want to do that. You know what I mean? That's what's kept me going. Like that's like the mental sort of mental food in a way on that. And the commercial side of it, it's just about, partly it's about security, I suppose, partly because of my upbringing. So, you know, we had, I wanted financial security. That's the easiest thing I can have. I had to come out of college. I had to work straight away. I could go back and live with my dad's flat. That was fine. But I suppose part of maybe that upbringing, I had to be able to stand off my own two feet is really important, very important to me in a way. And I know now it was a real drive then. Mm. I mean, I was grew up with social workers, police, bailiffs at the door. There's no way I'm having that I'm not going to have that. So
that was the driving
force. That was a real drive. I've always got to have money in the bank.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
So you became a photographer. As a successful photographer, you know, I guess you figured out pretty early on that, yeah, sure, you can make a decent living and you know.
Well, I think you could do back then. I mean, you could join the newspapers and you could make a living out of newspapers.
Right.
I met my wife. She was working in advertising and said, you know, well, yeah, I was getting pretty... So the Telegraph most of the time, they'd offer me a contract. I didn't want to do it because I was getting a bit disillusioned. So I was on features.
Mm.
And it was like, really started off quite interesting. Then it got into gardening features, car of the week feature, house of the week feature. Mm. I mean, really mindless stuff that I was like, okay, well, it's just like ching ching. I'm just keeping myself afloat with the income. She said, you should get into advertising because a lot of the guys were doing designer. They were working for designers. I mean, Network and places like that had a good relationship with design agencies. And she said, well, go and do some advertising. We'll just go and see them because they really want to do this. They love this reportage stuff. And I did. I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I was lucky that because Ingrid worked in advertising, there was a big art buyer at BMP, which was a big agency at the time. She sort of took me under her wing and helped me out, Katie Grogan, to see other art buyers and, you know, organise. Or she just talked to me how to get to see art directors. It took about a year of doing that. It was quite hard. I was doing it and working for the Telegraph, so I'd have a portfolio with me. If I got a job, I'd have to go and do it. Often it's in London, but sometimes it only lasts an hour or two. Sneak back to the Telegraph, leave my book at the reception so they wouldn't know I'm seeing people upstairs, and then come out and try and keep the appointments that I'd made.
Right.
You know, so there was a lot of doing that.
Yeah.
But I kind of really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're kind of the documentary type, or the kind of new stuff you were doing, I guess, in a way that was your sort of USP as an ad photographer, because, like you say, you know, sometimes they want that style or they're looking for that kind of thing.
Well, that's what I get asked to do. I get asked to do documentary work. I don't get asked to do anything, you know, still lives or anything like that.
No, it's very kind of niche, you know, very specific.
It's totally, I mean, and the odd thing is I suppose I went out with a portfolio that was purely documentary. Yeah. And when I, because I get other photographers, you know, saying, how do I get into it? And I show them my portfolio and they're like, well, God, how do you get work with that? Because it hasn't got any advertising in it, you know. Has at the back to say that I can do it, you know, tear sheets and stuff. But luckily, I suppose that's what people were looking for.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, I'm wondering about how you kind of, like you say, you keep them separate, but also one thing informs the other. And sometimes, you know, do you ever find that ideas kind of cross pollinate between your personal work and your advertising work?
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked this morning. I come from a meeting. I mean, I can't say, but if this goes ahead, it's a totally documentary approach. Which I've done in the past, go somewhere and document for maybe two weeks. This campaign that they're working on, and it's brilliant. I mean, it's that I'm quite excited about. Hopefully, being able to do it. So there's a lot of that kind of cross-pollination. But one thing I do like about the advertising world is they're quite keen on new technology. You know, they work. You know, there's new ways of working sometimes, which are quite interesting, which I quite like. You know, I suppose early social media stuff and stuff like that was quite interesting.
Mm. What skills do you think you need for one thing that you can also apply to the other? You know, in terms of documentary, you know, the personal work versus the advertising work. Are there certain things that, you know, stand you in good stead for both?
I suppose one thing I know, because my agent John he was at Magnum. You know, he's brilliant. I mean, my agents tell me really gets lots of work. You know what I mean? You need a good agent, otherwise you can't get much work, you know. Mm. And John and James and the team that they work with have really been very supportive. They've really helped me get on with the work. But he did mention that, like, sometimes some photographers get advertising commissions and then they go and get a 5-4 and a load of lights and all that kind of stuff and turn up at the shoot. And it was like, that's not the point. You know, they haven't asked you. They've asked, you know, I turned up with my donkey bag and my cameras, maybe a few lights back when we were shooting on Tranny and stuff because you needed it. Mm. But not to shoot adverts. And I would just approach it in the way I'd approach a lot of other shoots. And I'm quite good at working with people. That's the thing. I think that really helps.
Yeah.
So you get models and we map out scenarios and that kind of thing. And that works. I almost film things, I say. So it's like just mapping out, here's a scenario, this is what we need to do, come in the door, blah, 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 have a chat, you know. And let's just shoot that and then we'll see what works and refine it from there.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your balance between doing personal work and the ad stuff, is that about how, you know, in an ideal world, would it be different to how it is, or do you think it's about right in terms of, you know, presumably, you know, you do both because you want to. If you had like millions of quid in the bank, would you still do the advertising stuff?
Yes, I would. I think I'd still like to do. I think it's good just to get a brief and have to think your way around it.
To have that discipline,
I do enjoy, and I think it's quite. I think it helps. You know, like here's a brief. How are we going to answer this? How are we going to work around that? And it's nice. And it's nice to have your own little team. So it's the same group of people for the shoots. That's you know, when you work as a documentary photographer, you're quite on your personal projects, you're on your own.
Yeah,
you know, you're just with your local fixer and stuff like that. So it's nice to have that as well. I wouldn't give that up.
Yeah. What are you like at being on your own? You know, those early trips where you just take yourself.
I was an only child, so right. that's I'm quite used to. And then with, you know, living with my dad, and I'm good with my own space.
So you're sort of, yeah, you're quite self sufficient,
pretty self contained. Yeah, in that way.
How were those early trips? So you went to, like you say, you went to Ukraine. That was really your first.
That was my first really big, my first big project. So I was.
Did you kind of feel like you didn't know what the hell you were doing, or have you always been quite confident in yourself?
Well, I look back on it now and I think, what the hell was I doing?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just went there. I contacted the independence movement, found some of a mining family that I could stay with because I wanted to do a project on mining. That initially, I mean, the project ended up being about the family because it's much more interesting. And I got on with them well. And I just went out there and did it. And now I think, how the hell did I do that?
But yeah.
I did, you know. And it kind of, that became the blueprint for the. And it's funny, I always think I probably like working with families, possibly because of the lack of my own stable family when I was younger. I don't know.
Right.
So maybe I'm looking for.
Yeah, something you didn't really experience yourself, that kind of extended
something
family.
Something I longed for, but yeah. didn't experience and didn't, you know, but, you know, it was still something that I probably look for now. Because most of my work is based around trying to find, what I call, what we say, ordinary people, not to be condescending, but like, you know, like ordinary people, this is how they live.
Mm.
Yeah, and maybe there's a part of me that says, I wish I'd been able to live like that.
Yeah, maybe.
That kind of thing.
And, you know, that kind of modus operandi of going somewhere and finding a family to sort of as your kind of entry point into a wider community. That's a kind of, that seems to me like a thing that a lot of photographers. It's a great method. It's a kind of tried and tested technique for getting
a lot of people
things.
Talk about it now. Yeah, I mean, I think probably everyone's done it. I hadn't read about it as a technique. It's something I just did.
Yeah, it was kind of organic.
It evolved, and it's like, I found it very a really nice way of working.
Yeah,
because I mean, I like working with people.
Sure.
You know, so that was good.
Sure. Are you quite ambitious? Have you always been quite ambitious?
I suppose in as much as one wants to get on, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm
just lucky. I got into advertising at a time when I could and when it was more straightforward. I'm pretty focused, and I was focused about how I should work it. You know,
did you have a kind of master plan, as it were?
I had a bit of a master. Well, I had a background plan. I knew that I needed at the time during the AOP. They were the advertising photographers, like main world, you know, promotion. Because there weren't so many routes to promote yourself. So I joined them and I thought, well, if I put my Ukraine project in, I think it's got a fair chance of winning something because, they haven't got much of that and the industry's looking for it, and it did win a few of things, and then I managed to get into it. Just started the ball rolling, you know.
Right.
I was just able to do that,
right?
And I mean, I suppose also from what I've heard from people who've worked for some of the photography agents, some photographers they want the advertising work but they don't like it. They've got some, there's a thing about, oh, it's horrible and corporate, and you know, a lot of these art directors, they're thinking they're tossers or something like that. I've never come across anyone like that. They're all genuine, pretty decent, down to earth people, and I've got a different attitude. My attitude towards the news media is one that's why I don't want to work. I don't want to work for that because I think it's quite propagandist. So I find advertising work ethically easier and simpler to sit in bed with,
right?
You know,
which is kind of the inverse of what a lot of people.
It is. I mean, it's just people look at adverts and you know it's made up. Yeah, I'm going a bit beyond the sort of obvious, like, oh, we're reporting the truth, you're just making up these myths for corporate world. Well, actually, the advertising. Everyone knows it's a myth, so it doesn't work like that. People don't respond to it and go, oh, I'm being coerced in quite the way that I am with news production, which very subtly fits neatly into Western foreign policy goals and all that. You know, that's my political side coming out. I don't want anything to do with that. I mean, look at all the mess that's going on with Syria and Russia's involvement. I mean, it's being spun in a very particular way.
Yeah.
And, you know, go back to Roland Barthes, you know, image, music, text, how images and words work together to support each other in manufacturing the truth.
Right.
Advertising, there's none of that. Everyone knows it's a lie.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not necessarily a lie, but I mean, it's not the truth.
Well, we all know where we stand with it. Whereas, as you say, there's a lot more complexity to the news agenda than
there is.
Know.
I'm not looking. Photographers have to make a living, and You can work in that, but and that's fine. But the idea that it's somehow purer, I don't get.
Right. No. Yeah. So where else have you been? You also did a book in about Tokyo, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to Tokyo. I just wanted to do a story that wasn't just an easy story, non-political, straightforward. Looked like it might be fun. On Subure, which is the main station there, and on commuters. And when I came back, I mean, I did different aspects. I did people on the tubes, on the trains, people walking around the station. I was fascinated by these smoking areas that they had. The way the Japanese smoke was incredible. They had about 3 fags in a row, and taking in so much, they literally can draw half a fag down in a single drag. It's like, whoa. And like car commuters, that kind of, and then, But when I got back, I showed it to people, and I thought it's something that's just neutral and non-political. You know, I was thinking like Philip de Corsa and stuff like that, some of his work, which I really admire. And there was like, oh God, these people look so miserable. Oh, it ended up being a sort of part statement about, I suppose, you know, life in a busy capitalist city, basically. And the toll it's having on the people in there.
Right.
That's the response I got. So it's like, and then Paul saw it and said, oh, I'd love to do a book on it. So that's how we did our first book.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've had other books, but that's the first one I did with Paul.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
That was the last one.
Right. You're a very positive person. Where does that come from, do you think? You're talking about the fact that you like to... about the fact that you know, even when you're doing a story, you know, with a lot of negatives, you try and focus on the good side of stuff, and you very much believe in the kind of goodness of people. I'm just wondering where that comes from.
Where it comes from, I suppose part of my philosophy, I think that people are good. You know, and it's the shit that they land in that creates a lot of the shit for everyone, for themselves and for other people around them. And yeah, I think I try and focus on it. You know, I mean, part of the things with the Slum Project was, like, I mean, maybe it was a bit naive, but it's like, you know, here's some people, they live in these terrible conditions, but their focus is, you know, they want to provide for themselves, their families, their friends. They want to make sure if they have children that their kids have a better life than them. That's usually the first thing they say they want, you know, or they just want to have a better life for everyone around them. They have, and a lot of the concerns are the concerns that we all have. So I suppose I don't want to be like an essentialist and act like we're all the same, but there is quite a lot of us that is pretty much the same. And you see, my political views are that, you know, these things can be made and they can happen, but you know, the powers that be, the powers and the elites don't want that. They want to keep a lot of it for themselves. So there's solutions to this as well, which are economic and political. So and that's what causes a lot of the hassle.
Mm.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about whether photography can change anything?
I think that photography really can, it can inform, you know, but it's limited. It is limited. I mean, I'm probably thinking of becoming more politically active now, a bit more optimistic now what's happening in the Labour Party and stuff like that. So, yeah, I've got a meeting tonight. I'm going to go. I actually used to be in the Labour Party. I joined when I was 18, so I was quite political, you know. And people were back then, but, you know, everyone had to take a stance. I was a punk, and there were skinheads, you know. People made a stance. Mm. They seemed to have to in the late 70s, early 80s. So I joined. I mean, I even was a candidate for the Labour Party back then. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I might get back. I want to get back into that. So I think there is a positivity. We just got to keep working at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And around that time, you were saying about. So you were a bit of a punk at that time, and then there was a very violent incident which you were the victim of. What happened there?
When I was 15, I got stabbed.
Right.
Yeah. But that was good, because then, you know, I got a lot of compensation, which I was really surprised about. I didn't even know it existed until the police told me. And they gave you some of the money when you were 16, which I spent a little bit on a lens, and the rest of it I just spent on booze and drugs. And but luckily they gave me the bulk of it when I was 18, and I had time to sit down and think about what I was going to buy. And I bought some proper, you know, some decent camera gear.
Yeah.
So it did really help me.
So this is what I mean about you being a positive person. You see, you take a very kind of dramatic event in your life, and you see the good side, which is that you gave you some money to buy equipment.
Oh yeah, no, but you can imagine when you're 15, hey, I got stabbed. It was pretty cool. You know what I mean? As an adolescent, it's like, you know, I had a bit of kudos as well.
I can imagine.
So it was, yeah.
Did all that kind of, do you think that kind of stood you in good stead for some of the kind of hairy situations that you found yourself later on, though?
What getting stabbed? Or
having violence in your landscape, as it were?
I think it probably did, because, as I say, I don't get, people say like, oh, you know, you went there didn't when you just when you scared out your wits, when you're worried. I mean, a lot of journalists do this. I suppose maybe we all have this capability of not getting freaked out in a way. I mean, I certainly, and someone suggested actually that it was probably my upbringing that made me less freaked out and sometimes less aware of some of the subtleties of what's going on around me. Mm. Like I'm really unobservant. It sounds really bizarre, but I am. You know what I mean?
Unobservant.
Unobservant. Right. Yeah. I mean, unless I've got a camera in front of me, then.
So in a way, yeah, that can it can be help. It can help if you're a little bit kind of head in the clouds in a way.
Yes, exactly. Right. And my wife's just bought me a T-shirt that says "Head in the Clouds." Okay. That's me. Yeah.
An unobservant photographer, which is definitely seems like a contradiction.
It is one of my because when I haven't got the camera on me.
Right. Yeah, but when you've got
that's
the
why I can't. I'm not one of these people who carries a camera around all the time.
Right.
I tried early on to mix a holiday with some personal work. It just didn't work.
Right.
I've just got to be totally focused and possibly just with a fixer, quite alone, and then I can get on with it.
Yeah. How does your the stuff that you kind of learnt kind of growing up, how's that useful in your commercial work? You know, is it giving you people skills and that kind of stuff?
I don't really know. I mean, a lot maybe it has because a lot of my I don't know if it has because home was such home wasn't a good environment for me. So at school I was I suppose that sounds big-headed, but I was quite popular. I was very sociable, always going back to someone's house in the evenings, you know, pretty well had a routine of so Richard on one day, Carl the next, you know. This is when I was at junior school, and I think it probably did. So my world is out there, you know what I mean? It wasn't the world of the home, you know, so
yeah.
And that might well have helped.
I'm just wondering whether, you know, when you're doing these ad jobs and you're kind of getting pampered and you're earning, let's face it, quite stupid amounts of money.
Yes, yeah.
by the standards of most people.
By reputation. I mean, it's just...
Do you feel like, do you think about how far you've come from, you know, Richmond, you know, back in the day? Do you reflect on that?
I look around and think I never thought I would be able to own... I mean, luckily, with the housing problems and things like that, but a decent house, you know, and things like that, and go on lots of holidays with the family. Yeah, I didn't ever imagine that, and I feel very blessed that's just happened, you know.
Do you ever get that sort of slight kind of imposter syndrome that you know, you're not really, that someone's going to find you out, or you just, have you got quite, I mean, obviously after a lot of years of doing it, you get a certain amount of confidence, but
I have had that. I used to hate it, you know, at college and stuff like that, especially when I went to Polytechnic, you know, because of my accent and stuff like that. People would just take the piss out of you and things like that,
right.
Which I really didn't like. And I suppose I have got a I've got a bit of an, there is that inferiority complex, you know what I mean? Where like you, well, I suppose I've gone from a working class background. I'm fully fledged middle class now, you know what I mean? In that way. But, you know, I don't sit totally comfortably with it.
Yeah.
And lots of its values and things like that.
But you're sort of, you can fake it, as it were. And
I can still fake it, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you have
to,
because...
The kids don't go to private school, not even...
But there's a certain expectation, you know, part of doing those kind of jobs is about sort of, you know, selling yourself as a kind of brand, as it were. Do you know what I mean? In terms of advertising, they expect you to act in a certain way. They expect you to demonstrate a certain amount of you know, like I say, self-confidence or whatever. Or is that not true in your case, do you think?
No, that I mean, what I found amazing with advertising compared with editorial is that, right, first, one of the biggest shocks I had was when I finished the job, I got a massive thank you for doing the job. And I'm like, serious? I mean, you're paying me a fair bit of money here compared with what I get at the Telegraph. And you're thanking me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I should be thanking you. Because all I ever used to get from editorial was like, you know, or the picture desk is, if you got a phone call after a job, which the only time you get it is if you fuck the job up or they weren't happy with it, you know what I mean? And they just say, like, we just want you to do your thing, like, want to do what you want to do. It was a bit odd, you know, they're paying you a lot more money and they're giving you loads more space and loads more respect. And it's like,
right, really? Where's the downside?
What, you know, it depends if you like doing that kind of work. I like constructing that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, what I have found odd is when I've had McQuarrie, is I only, this is maybe a hint to, I don't know, other photographers as well, is that I, the portfolio I have is quite, it's very documentary reportage, but I only seem to get work, and it's not because, you know, I think because of what maybe the work I present, it's only the big agencies that give me work. When I've been quiet and I've seen some smaller agencies, they don't want to, that they can't use the work. And I think it's, maybe it's just a big, they are looking for, they're looking for a particular way of seeing and a particular eye. They're not really bothered about, it's only when it goes to the client, then they start asking like, well, have you got a shot of this? Have you got a shot of that? You know, they're looking for a particular way of seeing.
Yeah.
So I was quite lucky that I got into that. You know, that's where I was pointed into that direction. Yeah.
And in terms of personal stuff, you know, obviously you're still actively pursuing those personal projects.
Well, what I'm trying to do now is more stuff in the UK. I've been trying to do something about austerity. Probably it's been 4 years. I mean, working with 4 or 5 years, like working with some charities to see if I can get an inroads with families and people like that, and do a long-term project on. But it's been, I mean, I find the UK the hardest place to work in the whole world.
Really?
People are, there seems to be people a bit more suspicious. I don't know why. And you try and talk to an agent, a charity or anything like that, there's so many protocols to go through that it actually often stops the project. I managed to link up with one, managed to get something off the ground with Save the Children, but it did take a lot of work. We're trying to work with Shelter at the moment. I'm doing a lot of work with Shelter, trying to do the same sort of thing, but it's quite difficult finding people who are willing to let you do that.
Yeah, I wonder why is that, do you think? A kind of English reserve about things, or is there cynicism? Photography seems to have become something which people are suspicious of.
Well, it is. I mean, I thought that the thing I did in Tokyo, which is working in Tsuburaya in a station, I went to a few other stations as well, on the platforms during the middle of rush hour when they are super busy, yeah? I couldn't do that in the quietest period of the day at Waterloo. They'd just be you'd be thrown off.
Yeah.
Where's your permit? Why haven't you got this? What do you think you're doing? You're a terrorist. And there's all this, you're a terrorist, you're a paedophile, you're this, that, and the other. You know what I mean? It's so difficult. Yeah. That you only get that here. But in Tokyo, I only got asked to move on maybe after 20 minutes. And it was simply the guy coming up saying, look, I'm actually being very apologetic, saying, sorry, we're just too busy. You are actually getting in the way. We have they do have a very strict routine of how people get on and off trains. And I knew I was getting in the way, and it was fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't telling me, where's your permit? It was like, I'm awfully sorry, sir, you have to leave because it's just too busy for us. You're getting in people's way.
Sure.
And that was a fair point.
Yeah.
But not here.
Yeah.
I've taken shots of buildings in the street and had fucking, my security guards chasing after me, telling me that the lens I'm using is illegal.
Yeah.
Because it's big and white.
There's a lot of silliness out there. Yeah, definitely.
Actually, I'll tell you one great story. I had to do some shots, sneaking them a bit. It was of some scaffold, and it was at Stratford. They were building the Olympics, so I was on a part. They wanted some shots of just lots of cranes, so I went there with the producer just after the shoot. So we grabbed the cranes here from the street, shot them. Yeah, and the security guard came out and said, right, you have to delete those pictures. And I said, well, I'm not going to, so I'm leaving now. And he followed me, and he's saying, no, I'm not letting you go unless you delete those pictures. I'm not letting you go. And I just had to turn around to him and say, well, you lay a single finger on me, and I will phone the police, and I'll have you arrested for assault. So just go away. And he went. 2 weeks later, Alex, my producer, she phones me up and says, I've just had a call from my dad. And she comes from quite a posh background. I mean, I've been to their place. It's like a mini stately home up in Northamptonshire. And she said, yeah, my dad just phoned up. Two members of the special branch, because she was staying there at the time. She said, two members of the special branch had just turned up wondering what we were doing, taking pictures from the street. And it's like, And obviously they turned up to this mini stately home, and actually I think that my dad explained something, that I was a producer, and they all left looking rather embarrassed. But I mean, to go to those lengths.
What's happened in the world where something as stupid as that, you know, is become almost the norm? I think we've all got stories about this kind of crap.
I'm sure we have. I mean, the members of the special branch drive all the way up to Northampton.
Yeah.
There's
there's no sense to it at all.
No.
I mean, let alone the States, which last time I was in the States, which was a long time ago, well, you know, 10 years ago now, it was times 10 in terms of the craziness and the paranoia.
Really?
Yeah, kind of post 9/11, you know.
I suppose just after that.
Well, yeah. it was a while after, but I think this the general kind of mood is completely different. And, you know, the other side of it is, you know, you can't photograph kids anymore, period.
Oh, God, yeah. You know, the worst thing for me to do sometimes, if I have to do a recce and I have to look for playgrounds,
right.
And oh my God. It's like, you're like, okay, well, I'm literally want to look at 20 playgrounds. So I haven't got time to get permission from the council to do this. It'll take a week for each one. So you just have to go around. Yeah.
That's definitely going to raise some red flag.
Well, you show a press card and explain what you're doing, right, and show a layout, and they're like, okay, but I don't want to, you know, this is why I'm here, I'm not a pervert. You know, but it is a lot. I mean, it's difficult.
It's not that people shouldn't be, you know, wary or, you know, concerned or, you know, I'm cautious. It's just that when it gets to the point where it no longer makes any sense at all, you know, that when that behavior just becomes entirely irrational, that I just go, oh, you know what, just for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I mean, I find it a bit. It's a bit like social media, and Twitter now. It's become quite vicious for a lot of people, isn't it? You know, they get attacked and they get.
Yeah. What are you like on the social media? Is it something that you find useful?
I mean, the social media side of stuff, I suppose, because I get asked about that. You know, if you go and talk to some students at college. It's not going to be detrimental to do it, but it's not the main focus. And if you're not careful, it can really be quite a distraction. I got into it initially when it first came out. I still do tweet, but very occasionally. I'm a bit naughty. I don't read tweets. I just send one out every so often. That's it. And I don't know. I think I've got a few followers, I don't know, because that's quite simple and easy, and sometimes you get messaging, which is a bit like an email. The rest of it I don't do, but I think people have got to be careful. It's like, well, if you've got 1,000 followers or people on blog, what does that mean? They're not paying you. You've got to get out there and get paid work, otherwise you ain't going to be a photographer. You know, it's going to stop. That's the crux of it all, you know. You know, no commissions, and that's it. End of. And that's the really difficult thing. There's so many students now.
So what advice do you give to young photographers? I mean, first of all, in terms of doing personal projects, and then also in terms of earning money. I guess those two things are kind of fairly separate.
They can't. I mean, your personal projects are the thing that you've got to have a good body of work in your folio.
Let's assume you've already done all that.
Yeah. I started out 20 years ago. You know, it's like 25 years ago. So it's like, you know, different. It's a different world now, and there are a lot more photographers out there.
Yeah.
I mean, I say there was about a dozen photographers, but a dozen colleges doing a BA. In photography, film and television, there was only one doing a photography, pure photography degree, which was Trent, where I went. Now, you can do a master's in a subsection of photography. You know, it's got that, there's so much. And a lot of these colleges are out there just to, they run like businesses as well, which I think is another problem.
Yeah.
So they're...
Also, you have to think much more carefully about whether it's worth doing a course when you have to get into a lot of debt in order to do it. Like you say, when you and I went to university, they paid us money.
It was great.
And, you know, we used to spend it on beer. And that was basically the standard student experience.
That was kind of a lot of it, yeah.
Now, the standard student experience, I presume, is that they have to consider how the hell they're going to pay off their debt.
Take it personally. My children, I'm not going to tell them. They don't want to go to university, fine, go around the world for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I think you'd probably be even better off doing that, you know? Or I'm not sure about that anymore. Mm. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
So for me, it wasn't about getting. But I always knew when I went to college, it wasn't about the qualification. It was about 3 years being financed. And again, that balance. People said to me, I did balance it. I went out and had fun, but I always did the work, you know. So I knew why I was there. So
yeah.
It was 3 years of state-funded exploration of photography and also to get my portfolio together, to get me prepared for it all. And I thought, well, yeah, might as well take it.
Sure.
You know, but I'm not sure if that's what you should do now, you know. I think people really need to see interesting stories. They need to see interesting work. And then it's about how you get it out there. Blogging is one thing, maybe.
Mm.
But for commissioners, you've got to get it under the nose of commissioners. So, I mean, I've had some good stories recently where people have actually managed to get into ad agencies and see art directors and art buyers. So maybe they're opening their doors again a bit more.
Maybe.
That's the place to go. And then you can start doing your blogging.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sort out a bit of income first.
That's the thing, yeah.
So what about, what have you got kind of percolating, or do you have any specific plans in terms of the next thing? What are you going to be shooting?
The next thing I was thinking is, I suppose relating to some of the housing issues going on here, there's, basically I'd like to get into one of these. I tried it at the New Era. There was a New Era there. Where they were trying to kick out all the residents. There's another one at the Aylesbury going on at the moment where they've built a fence around the place. It looks horrible. Contacting people there. I want to do something about that kind of land rights, and I'd like to do something about land rights internationally as well. So I'm partly into researching about that.
Right.
It ties up, mainly because it's a way of, I hope, drawing people into the wider political issues around land rights and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you quite enjoy the research phase, or is that just a bit of a chore for you? What do you?
I don't mind a bit of research, but I just want it to get. I want to see the ends of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't like endless research. You know what I mean?
You know, you were saying about coming up against resistance and bureaucracy, especially in this country. Are you quite tenacious when it comes to cutting through that?
Yeah, I mean, there's always two ways of doing things. And often I say this even on advertising shoots, and we do things like do you do things officially or unofficially? You always do everything unofficially, yeah? And get to the people on the ground as quickly as you can. Traveling on some big ad shoots is like, well, should we get proper, you know, I always travel on a tourist visa just to, because it's straightforward.
Mm.
Yeah, things like that.
Mm.
And yeah, just try and avoid bureaucracy at all costs.
Yeah.
Because you get tied up.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything you'd do differently if you, in retrospect, how things have gone in the last 25 years?
No, there isn't really. No.
Seems to have worked out pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm quite a realist as well. You know, there's all sorts of directions one could have gone in. So. And overall, you look at it, and I look at it, and I think, well, I'm very fortunate. So, and I'm happy with that, yeah. Because it could have gone many different ways. You can always want more, but it's just there's no point. Yeah.
Adam, thanks so much.
I've enjoyed talking to you. Yeah,
that was great.
That's interesting. All right.
No, it was brilliant. Thank you so much for coming, man.
And thank you very much for asking me.